fun. Interviewing is not always the most fun. It's tough because it's something that's kind of new. You feel kind of weird asking people questions. It's something that as you practice, it will get easier, which is why I go ahead and do a test out on interviewing, because it's very
important.
February 24th. It tells you what direction to take your exam. So, but this is kind of where you get more fun. You get to do more, which is definitely more fun. You need to make sure that you know where all of these landmarks are, and that's something you're going to work on in lab some tonight. So let's go ahead and look at this next slide, because this gives you some answers here. Suprasternal notch up along the top. I mean, you kind of feel like a little notch along your neck here. That's where that's at. The manubrium of the sternum is up at the top part right up here. The body of the sternum's in the middle there. The costal angle has to do with where the ribs kind of come up and meet the xiphoid process here. The costal margin is the distance. Or the angle's the distance, because the margin is like where it's along the ribs here. You're going to want to be able to feel your ribs, because when you're listening for heart sounds, and we'll probably be doing this more next week, but you're going to be finding the ribs and finding those spaces in between the ribs called intercostal spaces, and you'll be counting down and locating where to put your stethoscope. So it's kind of good to become familiar with some of those terminology to where you can figure out what you're doing next week. The posterior thoracic cage, you have the spinous processes. Those are like your lumpy bumpies down the middle of your back. The scapula is your shoulder blade. The clavicle is your collarbone. So one of the things I think that's on test out number two does have the spinous processes. So you're going to go down and you're going to kind of touch each one of them as you go down your patient, which will be your lab partner next time. Reference lines, which we'll get to on the next slide here. The mid-sternal lines down the center. Mid-clavicular is kind of like halfway here, and you're going to kind of get the middle of the clavicle and kind of go straight down. It's kind of just near the nipple line. Anterior axillary line is like if you were to look at the person head-on and kind of get the very edge of what you can see head-on, that's where that's at. Doesn't really get into the side at all. Along the front there. Scapular line down the middle of the scapula, and the vertebral lines down the middle of the vertebrae. Didn't mean to move on, but I guess we're going to. Lateral lines. Remember we talked about the anterior axillary line kind of being where you are not really getting into the side. You have the middle one and the posterior one. So if you're truly talking about something on the side, it could be you're talking along the mid-axillary line as opposed to anything else. But those are important landmarks. So if you're describing a finding, that you can kind of describe where you're finding, because you can't really say it's on the patient's right side. You know, is it more anterior? Is it more posterior? Is it more mid-axillary? So you're going to want to be more definitive. The mediastinum is that middle section of the thoracic cavity that contains the esophagus, the trachea, the heart, and the great vessels. The lobes of the lung. Which side only has two lobes? Left. Why?
It's the heart.
It's also narrower than because of the heart. The right lung is a little bit shorter. Why? Think about your organs. What's there on the right side? Up in here, liver. And when you're listening to lung sounds, if you hear something abnormal, you're going to need to indicate which lobe of the lung you hear it in. Is it a left lower lobe pneumonia? Is it a right middle lobe? You know, you're going to have to be able to differentiate that, because that tells the next person where to listen to document improvement or not. So that's going to be real important. If you hear crackles in the bases on both sides, or if you only hear wheezes on, in the left lung, maybe they're scattered throughout the left lung, maybe it's only in the left lung. So it's going to be important to be able to differentiate where you hear things. The pleurae are, they kind of form an envelope between the lungs, and then, so you have your lung here and the chest wall, it's kind of that space in between. Inside the envelope is the pleural cavity. That space is filled with just a few milliliters of a lubricating fluid. And normally you have a vacuum that has a negative pressure. If you think about, like, if you've ever seen like the microscope slides, and if you would think about putting a drop of water between two slides and how they really don't move around very much, it's kind of a negative pressure that's holding those together. That's kind of what's happening inside your body. The trachea is anterior to the esophagus. It bifurcates just below the sternal angle into the right and left. The right is shorter and wider than the left. And they're basically dead space that's kind of filled with air. That air is not necessarily available for gas exchange. Where's the gas exchange take place? Further on down in the little grape-like alveoli. I don't know how to say this word. Because that's what the alveoli, where the alveoli are, the acinus? I don't know how to say it. But it's the functional respiratory unit that has the bronchioles, the alveolar ducts, the alveolar sacs, and the alveoli themselves. And that's where the gas exchange occurs. So you're up by your trachea, you're not having gas exchange when you're just initially breathing in air. It's when it gets deeper in the lungs that you're having that gas exchange. Okay, so you know, you're not having gas exchange through here. It's when it gets down into the alveolus. Okay. So there's four functions of the respiratory system. First of all, we want to supply oxygen to the body. It helps us with our energy. We have to take away the waste product or the carbon dioxide. It also helps maintain acid-base balance and helps maintain heat exchange, although this function is not as key in humans as it is in other animals. The chest size changes during the physical act of breathing, increases with inspiration, decreases with expiration. The vertical diameter length shortens because of the downward upward movement of the diaphragm. Okay. And the interior posterior diameter increases or decreases based on the elevation or depression of the ribs, depending on if you're breathing in or breathing out. Now, do we have to think about when we breathe? Good thing. You know, that would keep us busy 24/7. It's all involuntary. Where's the respiratory center located? It's in the brain stem, in the pons, in the medulla. There's a major feedback loop in the change between your carbon dioxide levels and your oxygen levels. So if you're having more carbon dioxide and less oxygen, it's a stimulus to breathe. So if you're getting too much of the negative, it wants to shift it to where you're getting oxygen. That's what makes you take a deep breath, is when your carbon dioxide level has gotten a little on the higher end, then it makes you take a breath and it evens things out with the oxygen. And that's the whole breathing mechanism. Okay. As I said, normal stimulus to breathe for most people is an increase in the carbon dioxide in the blood. That term is hypercapnia, hypercapnia. Yes. The spelling? Mm-hmm. Okay. hypercapnia. If oxygen decreases in the blood, That also will increase respirations because it's trying to increase the oxygen level, but it's less effective than if we have too much carbon dioxide. Okay, let's see. That just has more of the mechanics and kind of what's happening there. Okay. So going through some of the health history questions, you know, cough. Do you have a cough? When did it start? Was it gradual? Is it sudden? Do you have any shortness of breath? Any periods of time where you have a hard time breathing? What brings it on? For some people, well, whenever I get up and walk is the answer. How severe is it? How long does it last? Do they have chest pain with breathing? Have them point to where it hurts when they have that pain. Do they have any history of respiratory infections? You know, like a bronchitis. Maybe they're a person with COPD or emphysema. Not that that's an infection, but that's still a respiratory condition. Or asthma, another one. And you see a lot of that with kids. Pneumonia, those things are all important. Smoking, do you smoke cigars or cigarettes? Because that's gonna play a difference. Lung sounds are not necessarily as clear in a smoker. Typically in a young smoker who maybe hasn't been smoking very long, lung sounds are gonna sound good. You have your person who's been smoking for, I had a guy that he got really sick and went to convenient, and I think I mentioned him, and he's the one that he went into convenient care, and then they convenient care shipped him by ambulance to the hospital because he was so bad. He was having chest pain, had a bad pneumonia, and they're like, oh, well, yeah, you have emphysema. Didn't you know that? Well, I'd seen him one time for a respiratory infection a year previously. You know, I just saw him for that one illness, and then I hadn't seen him again. So he's like, I said, oh, did you smoke? And he said, yeah, I was a 5-pack-a-day smoker. So, you know, that smoking history, he must have just lit up as soon as he, yeah.
Yeah,
I
was an
5-pack-a-day. That's an expensive habit now. But he did. And so, you know, now he's paying the price because he's got permanent lung changes. You know, stopping smoking helps, but it's not going to undo a 5-pack-a-day smoking habit for a period of years. It just isn't. You know, smoking, not, I mean, he quit, and certainly that's going to help him some, but it can't totally undo the damage. So we want to know how many packs do they smoke, what age they started, how long have they smoked. Because sometimes different people, you know, maybe they were just a social smoker in college and they only smoked when they went out, and then the rest of the week they didn't smoke at all, and then when they were in their 20s they started smoking a pack a day, and they've smoked that for the last 15 years. You know, so different people are going to have different smoking histories, so we need to kind of get some details on that. Environmental exposure. You know, we've got a lot of things that are, you know, factories that put pollutants in the air. Where do people work? You know, if they're working at one of those factories and there's a lot of pollutants in the air, that may be something we need to be taking into consideration. Maybe up by where we are in Camargo, there's coal mine. A lot of people are retired coal miners, so the coal mine dust can cause issues. Maybe they're a farmer and they're breathing in some of those noxious chemicals. Maybe they're, and you don't find this so much in East Central Illinois, but in the big city, maybe they are outside in a heavy traffic area. Self-care behaviors that have to do with the respiratory system are going to be things like, when did you last have a TB skin test? Have they ever had a TB skin test? And, you know, the kind that they used to, and I'm hoping they're totally moving away from those, that are the ones that they take a little thing that looks like almost a little thumbtack and they go like that, not very accurate. I can remember years and years ago they used to do that, and the pediatrician would draw a circle around it and say, if it gets red beyond that circle, let me know. There wasn't ever any come back and have it read, or and we'll, when we get to community health, you'll learn a lot more about TB there. But you know, that's something that's kind of up and coming because there's more drug resistance to the TB that's out there. Yeah.
Well, how did they do the new test? Because I haven't seen it.
Well, there's actually two different ways to test. They do an intradermal where they take a needle and just go barely underneath the skin, and it forms what looks like a big old mosquito bite because it's a bleb. It's actually raised up off the skin. And then you actually go back and have that measured. The two-step test means you get two injections of that. So that's what you've probably had.
That's what we have to get for like.
Probably, yeah. And the other test that can be done is a blood test. It's more expensive to do the blood test, so they don't do that as often. But there are some people that it's a better situation for them to go ahead and do the blood test. You know, have they ever had a chest x-ray? Have they had their pneumonia or flu shots? Those are things we're going to want to know. A lot of this you saw last week. I'm not going to go through that again as far as the video is concerned. Of course, nearly everything starts with inspection. You want to look first. What do you see? So really looking at the shape and configuration of the chest wall, looking at the position of the person. You know, when you go to Walmart, watch how many people, and it's not because they're unable to get around in terms of orthopedically, how many people are leaning over their carts? It's because they can't breathe. They're in that tripod position because they probably have COPD. So yeah, you're gonna start watching people like crazy at Walmart. What's their skin color like? That tells us a lot about their respiratory status. If they're blue, they're probably not getting good oxygen. Remember last week, the tactile Frema test, that was the 99 or blue moon. Again, you're comparing sides, left side to right side. You know, if you're on the upper part of the, you're going to compare here to here. Then you're going to move down. You're going to compare here to here. And then here to here. We use the palm part of your hand, and you want to feel for differences. The key thing is what's different, or are they the same? Let's see. Something that might, maybe if you have a child that's swallowed like a marble that might have obstructed the bronchus, that could maybe cause a difference in the tactile Frema test. Maybe somebody has a pneumonia, that can cause a difference. Maybe they have a pneumothorax where one of the lungs has collapsed. That might feel different. Crepitus is a coarse crackling, and that occurs when it's almost kind of like Rice Krispies. You know, you get a snap, crackle, pop of Rice Krispies, it's kind of like that. But what happens is air has gotten out of the lung and has entered the subcutaneous tissue. The predominant note over lung fields is a resonance. It should be a low-pitched, hollow, clear sound. This is going to predominate in all the lung tissue of the healthy adult, as long as you're not listening over bone. I mean, over bone's going to change the sound of things. If you hear something dull and you're not over bone, then there's an abnormal density in the lung, like maybe a tumor or pneumonia. If you hear a hyper-resonance, which means things are almost booming, that's typical of your emphysema patients. That means that too much air is present in the lungs. And what happens with emphysema is they can breathe all the air in, but they have trouble getting all the air out. So that's why they have all that extra air in there. Okay, percussion. You're gonna start up here. You're gonna go 1, 2, 3. 1, 2, 3. This one is considered three spots over here. Then you're going to start, and you can start on either side. You can start here and move here, or you can start here and move here. So, and you're just going to go back from side to side. Just like that. Now, when you're listening, and percussion's something that takes some practice, so get the percussion. Some people do better with a tapping on their finger. Some people do better with using a percussion hammer and tapping their finger. Take a listen. If you go over the shoulder blade, this is where I usually tell people to start. Start the shoulder blade, put it over the bone, listen to the dullness of the bone. Then try to find in between a rib, even if you're doing it on the anterior to start with or the posterior, and get the tap. It's going to sound totally different. percussion, how many people have ever been to a healthcare provider and had percussion done on their lungs? Very few. Most people, most providers don't do it unless they hear something a little bit abnormal. Then they'll go percuss. And my daughter had a 2-week, 3-week pneumonia infection. Never once was she percussed. Probably should have been.
So you listen with your stethoscope?
That's where you're actually just tapping with your fingers and listening to the sound.
Okay.
So, Jan, I'm going to borrow you again. Sorry, you're guinea pig. You're the friend. Okay. So basically, you're going to be on bare skin. I'll turn you this way. Bare skin, but you're going to go like this. I'm over bone, so it's more dull sound. I'll see if I can. I don't know if through your jacket I can get anything or not. You hear that's a little different?
Yeah.
Versus. Just, there's a little difference in the sound between bone and over bone. So, it takes a while. You're going to have a sore finger for a few days. I mean, my finger's sore just doing that because I'm trying to get the sound. You can, as some people like to use the percussion hammer instead of using their other hand. That's fine, however you want to do it. Okay, so percussion locations are a little bit different than... when we go to auscultation, but we'll do that in a second. So, breath sounds. I've got a chart that gives more information on that, and that'll be here in a couple slides. Auscultation, remember with the percussion we started with 1, 2, 3. We don't do that when we're listening. The thing that most providers, how many times have you, I mean, you think about this, this is having somebody breathe in and out 18 times. For your test out purposes, you're going to have somebody that's extremely lightheaded by the time you're getting down to these 7, 8, and 9s. So what we usually do for test out purposes is we'll have you go ahead and do like 1, 1, 2, where you're listening with your stethoscope, and you're going to use the diaphragm part of the stethoscope, which is which part? See, you've got a stethoscope in your pocket. Let me borrow it. Okay, diaphragm here. That's the bell side. So we're listening. 1. Now, what we'll do for test out purposes is then you're just going to tell your lab partner, just breathe normal. I'm going to show the instructor where I'm going to listen to the breaths. And you're going to show the instructor so that they're not becoming out of bed. 8, 8, 9, 9. And that actually comes around to the side a little bit here on your 8s and 9s. Yeah. 8. But you got to be careful. I mean, I've had people try to almost listen to lung sounds down by the hip, and lungs aren't down there. So you got to be careful. Yes. Sure.
Sorry.
That's okay. Shannon. She's sorry. Okay. I'm going to have you turn this way. So you're doing a 1 and a 1. Remember, you're comparing left to right, right to left. You're going to come on down. 4, 5, 6, 7, and then 8, and 9.
Okay.
Okay.
So 9
is out. Yeah. And if you just kind of look at, yeah, you're just kind of looking over here. You're kind of getting the sides of the lung here. That's what you're doing. Yes.
So each spot is one full breath, like breathe in, breathe out.
If you were truly doing and having to get a full assessment on somebody, yes.
That's what you're
doing. Yes. Now, as I said, your patient's probably going to get lightheaded. So if you really need to get all those sounds, and you're going to find most healthcare providers don't listen 18. And then you got to do the front yet. That's the thing. You're not even done. You just got to do the front, you know. So if you're doing the 18 on this person, you might want to have them stop partway through. Don't have them take deep breaths when you're up here. You don't need to hear what's going on down here yet. Just have them take just kind of some normal breaths. Just breathe normally and just listen. Then when you start getting into 3s and 4s, now a little deeper. You may need to stop for a moment, let them kind of settle down. I don't know, I may need this yet. I'm going to hang on to it. Here. Okay. So, kind of important to know your positions, where you're going to be listening, because that's something that they will be looking at. This is a chart that gives you the type of sounds. And yeah, I had to squeeze in amplitude and some of the words in there, but it gives you an idea of the types of sounds, what it's going to sound like, if it's more inspiration or expiration, if it's harsh, where the normal location of that is. This would be a good chart to kind of put here. Adventitious sounds. I do have some actual, and my understanding is that the disc that comes with your book also has these on there, but I do have a site that I have kind of gone in. So we're going to hear some crackles.
Is this thing on? Yeah,
probably not. So,
oh, it is. Well, you know.
Okay, let's turn it up so we can hear it. Okay, so here's some crackles. So you can kind of, let's listen to normal one first. Oh, of course.
You probably won't let me update because I'm not like a somebody important.
Of course that would be this. All right. Normal lung sounds is what you're probably going to hear on your lab partner tonight, unless they've got some kind of an infection. Crackles.
If they smoke.
If they're young, you still will probably hear normal lung sounds. And sometimes, if even though you're having them take a deep breath, you're still not hearing good air movement in the bases. So that's where that might be diminished in the bases. And sometimes you also hear that. I don't know why that's not doing anything. It's like totally whiting out. It's trying to work. Well, this is such a bummer because it's worked on my computer. I don't know why we're doing something. Well, it's at least maybe going to let me an update. I want an email address and I can't do that. Well, I guess I could put my baby on it. Well, that's working. Wheezes are kind of musical sounding. It's like, we're just going to move on. We're going to try to come back to that. You look at the voice sounds. That's where you're going to take the stethoscope and you're going to listen on your spots, but then you're going to have them say 99. That's bronchophony. The voice should feel somewhat, should sound somewhat soft, kind of muffled. Maybe you really can't tell for sure what they're saying. You know what they're saying because you've just told them to say 99. But, you know, I couldn't necessarily tell you that just by listening. If it's crystal clear and sounds like they're talking in your stethoscope, then that's an abnormal. If you look at bronchophony. Egophony, you're going to have them say E, E, E. If it actually sounds like an E, that's normal. If it sounds more like they're saying A, it's kind of more like a goat sound, like A, A, A. Yeah. All right. Yeah, that's egophony. So that's what you remember, that E to A. And that would be recorded as E to A with the little arrow there. But that's an abnormal. So there's something going on with that lung. Whispered pectoraliloquy, I can't say it. You're going to have them whisper a phrase while you're auscultating. The voice is faint. It's again, real soft, almost inaudible. If the person sounds like they're whispering directly into the stethoscope because it's very loud, then that's an abnormal. So if you hear it like you're almost putting that stethoscope up to their mouth and you're really back here, that's abnormal. So that kind of gives you an idea of some different tests that you can do.
Is this done yet for chance? Downloads? Maybe. Okay.
I have a question.
Yes.
Would it be easier to do like the whole, backside, auscultating and...
Yes, I would do the entire backside first.
And that's the point where even though you have your stethoscope in, you shouldn't do, whole...
The idea is you want to inconvenience your patient the least.
Okay.
So you don't necessarily want to. It could be.
Okay.
Yeah.
So just as long as they're, yeah, I know moving.
And a lot of times, that's where people will just let it dangle while they finish, and then they'll go back and, but yeah, I may be in and out of the ears.
So you'll hold back and then be.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Okay, let's try this again. Normal one. I'm not hearing anything. It says Apple download, thank you. Okay, quit that. Let's try this again. This is such a bummer. You know what? If anybody wants this link, just email me and I'll send you the link. And that way you can just get in there and listen to them. Because crackles and wheezes, they do sound very different. So, you know, that's, and your CD that comes with your book should also have some of that on there. That's a bummer. All right, well, we've already gone through that one. Again, you're going to, the anterior chest, you start with inspection. You're going to get tired of hearing me say, start with inspection, but you're going to start with inspection. You want to look at the configuration of the chest wall. What does your patient's face look like? Do they look like they're gasping for air, or do they look like they're comfortable and they're breathing easy? What's their level of consciousness? If they're not getting good oxygen in, they're probably not going to be real coherent. I had a gentleman that came into the office that he could hardly walk. I mean, even getting him from the scale into the exam room, he was bumping into walls. And so the complaint was dizziness. Dizziness, I hate that complaint. It's so vague. So start with kind of getting some vital signs. First thing I find out is he's got 102.5 temperature, which for a child is elevated, but it's more significant in an adult to have 102.5 temperature. So I've got this gentleman with 102.5 temperature, and I don't know what made me go ahead and grab the pulse oximeter. I guess I was just kind of reaching to get different vital signs, and his pulse ox was 86%. And you normally will find people 97, 98, 99. Your smokers are going to be 96, 97, 98. They're just not quite as up. But everybody should basically get an A on that test, you know, 92, 93. That's on the lower end. You don't really even, that's not even that wonderful. 95 and above. So I've got a gentleman with an 86% O2 sat. So I start listening and doing an assessment, and I'm listening to his lungs. I'm like, okay, in my mind, I'm like, he's got to have a pneumonia. He's got to have a pneumonia somewhere. Very last lobe I listened to found it. I'm like, okay. So we did a nebulizer treatment, and I'm thinking, okay, if I can get his saturation up to, you know, maybe 92-93% after the nebulizer, I'll send him home with our nebulizer machine, send him home with medication. The bad side of this gentleman had no insurance, none. So he's extremely sick. And after we did the neb treatment, I did the O2 sat again, you know, gave him a few minutes to kind of 86%. Like, you're gonna have to go to the hospital. You really don't have a choice. You know, and today, people are not hospitalized for long periods of time. This man was in for 12 days.
Wow.
Yeah, he was sick, very sick. And there wasn't anything I could do in the office to make him better. He needed IV antibiotics, etc. So he, unfortunately, was going to end up with a big hospital bill for 12 days. But, you know, that's just something that, you know, he was coherent, but very dizzy. So that's something that, you know, looking at the nail beds, are they bluish? You know, what's the capillary refill? And when they're breathing in and out, do they seem to be working at it? You know, if you look at somebody who's working to breathe, these muscles in between the ribs, the intercostals, are going to kind of retract or suck in because they're trying to get that air in, and they're fighting to get good oxygenation. And accessory muscles, sometimes the neck muscles get involved if people are really trying to get good air in, and the respiratory rate will increase. And actually all three of my kids have had issues with hospitalizations when they were young, but the one in particular, the youngest one, actually had issues where he was hospitalized with an O2 sat of 79%.
Wow.
and his respiratory rate was over 100. You think about trying to breathe 100 times a minute, how fast that is. You know, our infants typically breathe faster than what we as adults do. But even that, that's probably 2.5 times as fast as he should have been. You know, top end would have been about 40. So what his age was. So, you know, what is their respiratory rate? What do they seem like when they're breathing? That's real important information. Anterior chest, palpate. You do tactile crevices. Again, remember that with the palm of the hand, 99, 99, 99, 99. Now, the female, we've got these things called breasts that kind of get in the way here. So you're not always going to have ideal listening or tactile crevices. You're only going to probably be able to do a couple of locations before you're going to run into breast tissue and it's going to get tough. Percussion, same thing. Guys, we can, you know, for the most part, you can pretty well do percussion with the guys, but you're going to do the same thing. And just kind of move on down, find your bone, find your space, and go in your space. Tap down again, and you're going to go side to side. And we'll look at those spots here in just a moment. You're going to have an area where you're going to get some dullness because of the heart. So that's also a possibility. Breath sounds will auscultate. Listen for the abnormal sounds. Let's see. So let's get onto this picture here. So you don't have as many spots in the front to percuss, but you're going to do the same thing. You're going to percuss here, here, come down, and compare side to side, side to side, side to side. So you've only got 5 spots. And the good news with this, and you'll notice that there's a slash between percussion and auscultation. It doesn't change on the for the front, so that's a good thing. That makes it a little easier. The back, remember, changed because it did the 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3, and then it kind of went into the spots where this stays the same. So then you're going to listen in all those spots again. Again, with females, you're not going to be able to listen in spot number 4 necessarily, but you can come down here and listen in spot number 5, and you can pretty well get 3. So maybe you're going to miss a spot because of breast tissue and percussion. Okay. Forced expiratory time is the number of seconds it takes for the person to exhale from total lung capacity to residual volume. So in other words, if I take in as deep a breath as I possibly can, the number of seconds that took, that's your forced expiratory time. And pulse oximeter, we mentioned briefly, that's, remember, that non-invasive, it's where they put the little thingy on your finger. Infants, a lot of times, they'll wrap it around the baby's foot or their toe. And it assesses arterial oxygen saturation. Normal, again, you want 97 plus on your non-smokers, probably 95 plus on your smokers. You have to kind of look at what their hemoglobin level is, their acid-base balance, their ventilatory status. They kind of take those things into consideration. And the 6-minute distance walk has to look at what that does is you have the patient walk for 6 minutes and it kind of assesses their level of breathlessness. And you use a pulse oximeter, and if their saturation falls below 85%, then it's you're going to be more covered for like oxygen therapy. Sample charting gives you an idea of subjective, the kinds of things that the patient's going to tell you. Objective, these are going to be the things that you're going to assess, actually go and measure and inspect and auscultate and percuss and palpate. These next things will kind of look at some pictures here. Barrel chest, that's what you see a lot of times with the emphysema. The anterior posterior diameter is equal to the transverse diameter. In other words, what you're getting across here is equal to here. So it looks more barrel-like, it's more rounded, which is where that kind of comes up with that term. Kyphos, or this was the scoliosis first, okay. Scoliosis is a lateral S-shaped curve to the spine. It has to do with the thoracic and the lumbar spine. There's usually some rotation of the vertebrae in there. If you're assessing for scoliosis, you're gonna wanna have your patient kind of bend over and reach toward their toes. They don't necessarily have to touch their toes, just reach toward them. And you want to look at the scapula and make sure that things look even, their spine looks straight, their hips seem to sit evenly. We have a patient that we're actually in the process of getting sent over to, and we've had a couple that have already had surgery due to scoliosis. So it happens quite frequently. Kyphosis, this is the humpback. Typically, we'll see a lot of this with aging, the dowager's hump, where that kind of humped up here on the top part. Yes?
How do you do CPR on someone with kyphosis?
How do you do what?
CPR. I've heard horror stories of people like going to do CPR and they snap their spine before.
Okay, let me ask you this. If you're needing to do CPR on somebody, they're probably not in real good shape anyway. You're better off trying to give them CPR than not. These kinds of things, it's not ideal. But if you don't give them CPR, what's going to happen? They're going to be dead. So, you just kind of have to risk benefit, okay? In this case, there may be a risk of snapping the spinal cord or snapping some vertebrae or whatever, but the benefit, the risk of not doing it is the patient's going to die. So, you got to kind of look at that. Okay. A sigh is a purposeful, and everybody sighed before. Oh no, we got to have a quiz today. That expands the alveoli. Tachypnea is a rapid, shallow breathing. So bradypnea is, it's a slow breathing. So you have greater than, and you're looking at an adult here, greater than 24 is tachypnea. Bradypnea is less than 10 in a minute. Hyperventilation has to do with an increase both in rate, so you're not only breathing faster, but you're breathing deeper. That can happen when somebody's extremely fearful, maybe they're overly exerted, maybe they're anxious. Also can occur with diabetic ketoacidosis. You may have heard of Kussmaul's respirations. That's when they're trying to blow off the excess. Other conditions as well. You hear about where they say, oh, breathe into the bag. They're trying to get them to slow down a little bit. Hypoventilation has to do with an irregular shallow pattern. That can occur with an overdose of narcotics or analgesics like Tylenol. Can also occur with prolonged bed rest. Chain-Stokes respiration is a cycle in which respirations kind of wax and wane, but it's still in a regular pattern. They increase in rate and depth, and then they decrease. And then they increase, and then they decrease. And this is something that's normal in the infant and somebody who's aged and is sleeping. That's kind of a normal pattern. So if you ever get a chance to watch grandma or a baby asleep, just kind of watch and see if they don't kind of do the they're sleeping. You're going to notice that. And then they kind of go back into the rapid thing again, and then they kind of come back down into the slower thing again. Biots is similar to chain stokes, except the pattern's irregular. And that's something that you're going to see more with like a head trauma or a brain abscess or a meningitis or encephalitis or a heat stroke kind of thing. Chronic obstructive breathing, normal inspiration, but a prolonged expiration. And what it's happening is they're trying to overcome airway resistance. We talked about that barrel chest. They're taking a normal inspiration in, but trying to get all that out because it's just that much more work. There's air trapping inside the lungs, so they're really trying to get all that out, and they really don't have time to get a full expiration before inspiration is happening again. Other terms, stridor. You hear this a lot in croup and acute epiglottitis. Sometimes with foreign body inhalation, it's a type of sound that hurts. I don't have it. I thought, oh man, that does hurt. Pleural effusion is a collection of excess fluid in the intrapleural space with compression of overlying lung tissue. Some of these are kind of self-explanatory, so I'm skipping over them. You know, lobar pneumonia, and pneumonia is a pneumonia, bronchitis. And most people have had that before. CHF, congestive heart failure. That's actual pump failure. The heart, of course, is a pump, and when it doesn't pump the way it's supposed to, there's an increasing pressure of cardiac overload. It causes pulmonary congestion. So we have increased blood supply in the pulmonary capillaries, and they become engorged. And then we have issues with edema, and you have issues with when you listen to the lungs. They sound all gurgly, and because they've got fluid on the lungs, so to speak. Pulmonary embolism, that can actually be made up of a blood clot, an air bubble, or a fat globule. I think what show was that I was watching? In fact, I am watching, because one of the things I do when I'm on the exercise bike is I watch my iPod, because that's TV episodes. It's the only thing that passes the time. So I was watching an episode of Castle, and this particular person had a needle mark on the neck, and what killed her wasn't a poison, it was an air embolus that caused pulmonary embolism. Somebody taken a needle and just had, and he did the carotid, put a full syringe there. Air's not supposed to be in the bloodstream. Now, that said, I'm just going to give you a little FYI here. Okay, you know how, and then those of you who are in foundations and starting to do some of the IVs, and you know, you don't want any air bubbles in your tubing and all this stuff, and that's all well and good. So I'm a new nurse, and I'm ultra paranoid because you're not supposed to have air bubbles in there. So I'm getting ready to have some surgery, and I see that the anesthesiologist, and I'm like, oh my gosh, that's like a big bubble. And now, oh my gosh, I'm thinking, okay, if I live to tell about it, I'm going to have learned something. You don't have to get every single tiny little bubble out. Little bitty bubbles are going to be absorbed by the body. It's not going to be a big deal. It's the huge bubbles. You don't want to have this much of your tubing be air. If, you know, a little minuscule bubble's there, it's not going to hurt anything. So that's just kind of an FYI. That busted the heart. Don't get paranoid. So you can. A lot of these embolisms will occur, like they'll start in the lower part of the body, and we'll talk about DVTs later, deep vein thrombosis, where they detach from maybe like the leg, and then they float up through the bloodstream and then get clogged in the pulmonary vessels. 95% of pulmonary embolisms have started as something in the legs. ARDS is acute respiratory distress syndrome. That is usually as a result of an acute pulmonary insult, like a trauma, that damages the alveolar capillary membrane. What happens is it leads to increased permeability of the pulmonary capillaries, and therefore goes into pulmonary edema. Okay, so tactile tremendous findings would be increased when? Which one? What do you think the best answer is? I'm hearing it. Speak loud.
See.
They may have a little bit with mild pneumonia, but you're still looking at that. It's probably going to be a small enough area. You're really not going to be able to pick it up with your hand. Remember, tactile fremitus, 99, 99, 99, 99, 99, 99. Or blue moon, whatever you want to say. Okay. We didn't want to talk about distance. You know what? I'm going to just tell you this one so you know that. The correct answer is C, because 50 and 100 meters is a little bit too short of a walk, four blocks. Your patient may be passed out on the ground. So 300 meters is a good kind of in between. Okay. Let's go ahead and start head and neck vessels. Anybody need to take a, you know, if you need to get up and go to the bathroom, I don't take offense, but I'm feeling stressed.